What are you doing with your life these days? What's the most exciting thing that happened to you in the last day? Tell me something really exciting. You what? Tell me something really, 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 really exciting. Huh? You went to what?
A buffet.
Oh my God. Tell me that you met the love of your life. Come on, I want to hear some details here. Give me some juicy stuff, Charles.
In the last 24 hours?
Yeah.
Nothing really happened in 24 hours.
Oh God. What a dull life, man. I could write a book on my last 24 hours, I'll tell you that. That's for darn sure. No further comments on that. Jessica's shaking her head, but she knows it's the truth. Oh, my God. Okay. I'm glad that... Most of you like Harry. He's a really, really terrific guy. Strange guy, but a terrific guy. And, you know, anyone who jumps in graves and pulls up and exhumes body has to be a little bit strange. But in any case, he gave you a little bit of dose of reality on Tuesday, more than that I wanted him to be honest with you. I wanted him to show you a few pictures, but I didn't want him to go on for about 40 minutes. And so I hope it wasn't too nauseating for many of you. I still have that white face in my mind. I can't get rid of it for some strange reason. So hopefully it'll fade over the next 24 hours or 48 hours or something like that. How'd you like those pictures, Jack? Yeah, very disturbing. I just like positive things in my life. I don't like negative things. Okay. So I'm glad to see you back again today, and I'm glad to be back on the floor in front of you again. It's been a while. I must say, scheduling these speakers is really throwing me off. Hopefully, there won't be any more rearrangements of the speakers, and the next speaker is going to be very, very, very special, as you will see, related to one of the films that you saw yesterday in discussion. So our next speaker, I'm not going to say very much about today, is going to be Dr. Michelle Evans, and she does exactly what you saw in your DNA testing prenatal genetic diagnosis film yesterday for discussion. So she'll be talking all about that. And it's going to be, when she's here in a couple weeks, it's going to be a lot of fun, as you will see. A lot of fun for Gloria, it's going to be a lot of fun for Mike. And it's going to be a lot of fun for the rest of you. So let me catch us all up. So just going to remind you that the take-home test was supposed to be given out this week, but I wanted to give you a couple lectures on the law, which I'm going to do this lecture Tuesday. Starting next Thursday, we're going to switch from science to law and a little bit of political science. And I wanted to get into those lectures before you had your take-home test, because one of the questions of your take-home test is to write a patent, and I need to tell you something about patents before you have to write a patent, and so that's why I've delayed it, handing it out. Hi, Matt. That's why I've delayed handing it out about a week, but you'll still have 2 weeks to do it. It'll be due on the 28th of February, and you'll have this midterm oral, and I'm not going to talk very much more about it today. I'll tell you more about it on Tuesday. Next week's discussion, as I said, it's going to be a lot of fun, but it also means it's going to be a fair amount of work on your part, and that's why I didn't give you any quiz for this week, and that's why I didn't give you any discussion articles for this week, because I wanted to give you a break, because you're going to have a lot of preparation in order to do this trial of the century in the moot courtroom at the law school, and Jessica will give you a handout on Tuesday exactly where to go. You will not come here for your discussion. You will go directly to law school, but you're going to have to plan it in advance. I'll say more about this on Tuesday. But part of the trial is being given out today. Is that correct? So when you leave, there will be a trial for those of you that are in Gloria's discussion and a trial for those of you that are in Mike's discussion. They're different. Please take the one for your discussion because that's where you're assigned your specific characters. Please get together between now and Tuesday with everyone in your discussion to discuss your roles and what you have to do. You're actually going to have to write your own dialogue because I just scripted it out very generally. And what we want you to do is to be able to come in prepared. And the judges will be Gloria and Mike. I'll be there too as a Supreme Court judge. They'll be the Superior Court judges. And they'll be leading you on, so to speak, for those points that were missed. And as you'll see when you read the play, it's very scientific, very conceptual, and very much like your concept questions that we give out, and you'll have to address certain points. And along with that, there's going to be some reading that you're going to have to do. The main article is when science... where's my pointer? I don't seem to see it anywhere. When science... No, I want the good one. $200 one. I don't like discounts. I only like Porsches. It's true. When science takes the witness stand, that's the main article. It's a Scientific American article. It's a little old now. It's about 10 years old, but the points are there. A lot of the things that the article raised have been addressed, have been taken care of in terms of what's in the databases, what kind of ethnic groups. Harry alluded to that on Tuesday, but that's the main article right there. Then you'll be in the courtroom. Come prepared. We're going to film it. It's going to be on the web. But the point here is to read that Scientific American article. There's another article, which is general. It's a Newsweek article. You can read it. It's a good overview of how this stuff is used in the law. But then there's a couple chapters, one from a chapter in a book on forensic DNA analysis, and that one will tell you all about scientific testimony, and this is going to be important because you're going to have to know a little bit about the rules of evidence. And the precedent for that is a 1923 case called the Fry case, because there's something called the Fry test, and you'll read about it in this article over here. The Fry test on the federal level has really been superseded by what's called Daubert. You'll have to read a little bit about Daubert, but in reality, the Daubert standard doesn't apply to all states. It just applies to federal trials, and since this is a state trial, you'll be dealing with Kelly. It's another case, People versus Kelly, and People versus Kelly is how you can look at science in the courtroom and evidence and witnesses and whether you can use a DNA blot or a PCR, all those other kinds of things. So you'll need to look at these things. I handed this out about 2 weeks ago. This is relevant. But the key here is this chapter, you're going to need to read that chapter, which is from an introductory genetics book on how to calculate these allelic frequencies and how to get the probability of matches and what the probability means. And in reality, you're going to need these for your take-home test anyways, so they're geared to it. And these things are supplementary, but this one by Rothstein, who's a really incredible lawyer who writes a lot about ethics in the law, this little article, I think it was from the Journal of Medical Forensics or Journal of Law and Forensics, is very, very, very important in terms of talking about the limitations of this technology and what should be watched out for in trials using DNA testing. And I think you really need, it's only a small two-page article, but look at that one because it really gives you this critical thinking. Yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. And so all those things will be very useful in terms of your trial. Okay. Any questions? Some of you are going to be defense attorneys. Some of you are going to be prosecutors. Some of you are going to be jurors. Some of you are going to be scientific witnesses. Some of you are going to be the science experts. Some of you are going to be heading, you know, DNA testing companies, all of this stuff. So you're going to have to be able to come in and be able to explain what a DNA blot is, what an RFLP is, what a VNTR is, what an allele is. All of those things will bear because that's if you're a witness, for example, a scientific witness, and someone is the defense attorney, they're going to say, you know, what's a DNA blot? How did you get these numbers? How did you do this? And you're going to have to know that, and you'll have props, hopefully you'll have diagrams, and make it just like a real court case. And this is something that everyone that's gone through HC70A has had really a... We have some really funny lines that comes up as Mike's laughing and Gloria... I mean, there's a lot of funny things happen in these court cases, so it's a lot of fun. And it'll be interesting to see what kind of costumes you guys wear. One thing I want to say is when you enact your murder outside the law school, no guns, you know, as quiet as you can be, you're going to be filmed right as you do it. This thing is going to be up on the web, as I said, about a day after you do this trial. There'll be two of them, one for Gloria's discussion, one for Mike's discussion, and you'll be able to see yourself like in Hollywood. Okay, let me just go over what we did last time just to catch you up on where I'm at, and then I'm going to move forward, and I'm going to have some questions for you, but I'm going to save them for a bit. So where I was last time, which was about a week ago, is I was talking about the functions of genes. And a lot of these things are starting to make a lot of sense to all of you, I know. But what I like to do is conceptualize all these things for you so it all holds together. And so last lecture I talked about the structure of DNA, as you recall. I talked about the anatomy of a gene, 5 prime, 3 prime, 3 prime, 5 prime, upstream, downstream, switches, sense strand, transcribe strand, all of those things that are important in understanding how genes work. I talked about how genes are organized on chromosomes and how they're next to each other, and I visualized some genes for you, and I talked about regulatory information and how you can change information with respect to switches. And I talked about this novel stuff, really novel stuff of engineering, using genetic engineering to, in fact, engineer new kinds of organisms. And we talked about the eye being on a leg. We talked about the eye being in different parts of a fly's body and talked about how these switches can be coupled with these regulatory genes, genes that control the formation of organ systems, and it can be used to do all kinds of different stuff. In other words, you can use genetic engineering to engineer new animal forms, new plant forms, new body forms, and all kinds of different things. And I'm going to tell you today the basis for how you can do that. And so it's pretty nifty stuff. And as I said last week, and everything becomes possible. And it's going to be up to you to decide what you want to do and what you don't want to do with this technology. And hopefully the question is how far we should go, and I'll come back to a little bit of that today. And you will see, hopefully I'll get to it, something fairly spectacular today. I like to show you some things that are fairly spectacular, but I'm going to show you something today that's really going to... Your eyes are just going to pop out when I show it. That one's popping out enough. But when I show you what one gene can do, and when you modify a gene and what it can do, I think you're going to be very, 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 very surprised. So keep in mind that one can do a lot of things with genetic engineering, as I've said for the last 4.5 weeks. Okay. Having said all that, where am I today? And what are we going to be doing? So let's go today. So what I'm going to talk about is the function of genes. I know that you know a little bit about it, but I'm going to conceptualize it for you so that you can really understand when genes are engineered in genomes, what exactly happens, how these things work, and why genetic engineering, as I've said many times, is very natural and uses, quote, natural processes. And so what I'm going to talk about is how genes are replicated, and I'm going to lead into the polymerase chain reaction from gene replication because it's important, and Harry started to talk about it a little bit on Tuesday. And I'm going to talk about how mutations occur, which should be obvious to all of you now. And I'm going to talk about how genes then go to proteins in a very general way because most of you know quite a lot about it. Talk about the genetic code, DNA and RNA, but then what I'm going to do is compare and contrast, again, reviewing what you had in discussion a few weeks ago, gene activity in bacteria and in eukaryotes, but then I'm going to show you some surprises. And then I'm going to end up by basically concluding for you what you already know, and that is that it's modular. You can do anything you want by building up different sequences. And that's the fun part, and I'm going to save the surprise for last. So I'm going to give you some insights that you haven't had before, but some of them are going to be, I think, fairly obvious to you, but it's going to conceptualize everything in a way in which now starts to bring things together. So you've been thrown into the pool, and cold water has been thrown on your face, and you've been hit with all of these different principles that have been very new, with a very new language, and now what I'm going to do is bring it all together for you, so you start saying, oh yeah, now I see it. Oh yeah, now I see that. Now I see this. Now I see that. And by the end of this lecture and the next lecture I give you, it's going to make a lot of sense, and then we're just going to switch and go right into the law and politics and then come back to science, and you're going to see how it's all tied together, as I promised you a few weeks ago. Okay, let's talk about DNA to proteins, DNA to DNA. We talked about two of the most important principles of the genome, and genes is one, replication, to be able to pass functions on from generation to generation, and then be able to direct an organism to carry out a specific function. And I talked about that in the context of the Avery experiment, you know, changing avirulent to virulent. We talked about it in terms of antibiotic sensitivity to resistance, all kinds of different phenotypes. But the key here is that the genome has to be replicated in order to perpetuate that engineered trait from generation to generation, and then that engineered trait has to manifest itself. And the most important thing that I'm going to tell you today that I don't want you to ever forget is that if you don't have a functional protein, you don't have a trait. If you don't have a functional protein, you do not have a trait. If you don't have a functional protein, the word is functional, meaning the protein can be there, but it might be silent. And you read an article about that in terms of blood clotting, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that next week. But the point is that you have to get a functional protein in order to get a trait. So the red cabbage had a functional enzyme that was able to make a red color. And when that enzyme stopped being functional by a mutation, you got green color. So the key here is that traits that are engineered are due to the presence of a new protein, but due to the presence of a novel functional protein. So the key in genetic engineering or in molecular biology, obviously, but let's just say it from a genetic engineering context, the key here is to replicate the gene that you insert using the processes of gene replication in the cell in which you stick that gene, and getting that gene to be able to produce, again, a functional protein. And if the functional protein is not made, then the trait cannot be manifested. So if you have a gene in a bacteria, a human gene, you're not going to get a protein unless it's a functional protein. Not going to be able to get a protein to be like insulin or whatever unless you can carry out those particular processes. So let me dissect them and then tell you how they're relevant to genetic engineering, to the law, and all kinds of other things that we've been discussing. And I'm going to interrupt this by asking you some questions along the way, so don't worry about that. You'll be surprised and have to go to the board and all of that good stuff that we haven't done in a long time. Mike's going like this. You're learning, Mike. Okay, what about replication? How the genes pass on from generation to generation? Well, the most fundamental principle of a cell, what's unique to living cells, is the ability to divide, obviously. And the ability to divide is a very complicated process that I'm not going to go into, but clearly it involves the replication of genes and the replication of the genome. And what it means is that each cell has to divide itself so the genome containing all of the genes is replicated almost identically, if not identically, from generation to generation. When you slough your skin cells off in the shower or whenever, the skin cells have to divide and make new skin cells that are exactly like the ones that were sloughed off. And so it's a very precise, very accurate, very specific process, and if something goes wrong to prevent this process, that is, if there's a defect in the machinery to replicate the chromosome or replicate cells, cause cells to divide, it can be lethal in a single-celled organism or in a multicellular organism such as ourselves, it can cause cancer. Because cancer in human beings and mammals is due to defects in cell division, uncontrolled cell division. So it's a very elaborate, highly controlled process. So the question becomes really, is how does this DNA, I'm not going to get into the process of cell division, but how does this DNA get replicated at each division? Every single solitary time one of your cells divides, the genome, the genotype, the sequence of the genes must be replicated from generation, generation to generation exactly as it is. In other words, the sequence of the double-stranded DNA in your chromosomes has to be faithfully replicated. And the question is, how does that happen every single time that cell divides? Every single time that cell divides, it produces a whole bunch of other cells, and each of those cells is a clone, as you know, because if there's billions of cells in that colony, every one of them is genetically identical to each other because the DNA machinery is accurate. They're genetically identical because the DNA machinery is accurate, and the chromosomes are being replicated faithfully from generation to generation to generation. You like that, Brian? Pretty nifty. Can't tell you how accurate this is. If you have a genome like ours, which has 5.5 billion nucleotides, every time one of your cells divides, those 5.5 billion nucleotides is copied almost identically with only 1 to 2 or 3 mistakes per cell division. It's amazing. It has to be that way because if it wasn't, we would be dead. Now, how does this process of DNA replication occur? It's really nifty. I wish I had time to give you the experimental basis for this, but it's probably one of the most elegant experiments in molecular biology. It's a little beyond this class. But the point here is we have a double-stranded DNA, 5 prime to 3 prime, 3 prime to 5 prime, anti-parallel, phosphodiesters. On what, Shauna?
On the outside.
Why is it on the outside? Who showed that it was on the outside?
I was still talking to Rosalind Franklin.
Rosalind Franklin showed that they were on the outside?
I know she at least hypothesized that she did.
You sure about that?
It was in the book, so yes. Mm-hmm.
Who showed that the bases were on the inside?
That was Francis Crick. No. James Watson, I'm sorry, right, I get them
exactly.
James Watson did.
And how do they derive at that model? What pieces of evidence did they use?
He mostly used just pieces of the model put together. He knew
so
the structure of purines and pyrimidines.
So just give me a few things that they used to come up with this beautiful model of the DNA molecule.
They had Chargaff's ratios between the AT and GC
Wonderful.
Base pairs
mm-hmm.
in the DNA molecule.
How did Chargaff get those ratios?
I don't know. Let me think.
Did he look at the chemical composition of DNA?
No, he didn't.
Well, how would he get the ratios if he didn't look at the chemical composition
I guess
of the DNA?
He didn't look at the molecular structure, obviously.
No
of
one
DNA.
Did in those
no.
days.
So
he looked at the chemistry of the bases.
He did, and he saw that the percentages were roughly equal in every
did
organism.
Did he know what that meant?
No, he didn't put it together as far as the molecular structure.
He didn't put anything together, did he?
He just had.
Why do you think he was so bitter for the last 50 years of his life?
Probably because that was one of the two major steps that needed to be made.
Pardon?
That was just a very important step in.
Why did he think he was so bitter, though?
Well, he wasn't acknowledged for it.
Chargaff's a very bitter man. In his old age, he even wrote an editorial to the New York Times saying that genetic engineering was going against nature and we should never do anything like this because something which would be an abomination. In any case, what else did they use to come up with a model of the DNA structure?
They used
Chargaff's rules.
Chargaff's rules. They used crystallographic
mm-hmm.
X-ray imagery in mm-hmm. order to...
Who was the first person that had the idea to use X-ray crystallography to solve the structure of DNA? Who had that idea?
Was it Wilkins?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Wilkins was the one that had that idea. Do you think that was a very original idea?
Probably.
Yeah, exactly. No one had thought about that before. Let's use X-ray diffraction to find the structure of DNA. I mean, if it wasn't for that idea, you would have never followed that technique to be able to solve that structure. What else was used? Find out about this. Let's ask Lisa to help you. What else was used?
Just basic. Basic common, like, chemistry knowledge.
Chemistry knowledge of what?
Of, like, how molecules form bonds.
Yeah, basic knowledge of chemistry, absolutely. No question about that. They didn't know anything about hydrogen bonds and bond angles and all those things. If they didn't know about the chemistry of nucleotides and what the atoms in the nucleotides were, they'd never been able to come up with this kind of stuff. So that's true. So we have Chargaff's rules, and we have chemistry of nucleotides, and we have bonds, and hydrogen bonds, and covalent bonds. What else? Patricia. What else? You guys are doing well. Not on. What else?
I'm nervous.
You're nervous?
Yes.
Should I get closer?
No.
You sure?
No.
I'm going to. More nervous?
Yeah.
Turning red?
Uh-huh.
Have you ever been so close to a professor in your life?
Yes, but not.
Been closer to the professor than this?
No.
Closer than this? That's pretty tough. Ah, sorry. Now we're learning something new. Okay. So what else?
They learned from Rosalind's lectures.
Mm-hmm. About what did they learn from Dr. Franklin's lecture? Hmm?
First, Watson actually gave the wrong numbers for the water.
Mm-hmm. What?
He
smelling this stuff.
Go ahead. I know.
I know you never saw anyone as crazy as me, and you never will. Okay, so just enjoy it.
Okay.
Isn't that true, Gavina? Go ahead.
Okay. Well, from her lectures, they learned how much water it contained.
So they learned
a little bit about
even though Watson screwed it up.
Right.
They learned a little bit about something about the structure of the DNA from these X-ray diffraction patterns. What else did they use? What was so useful about that X-ray diffraction pattern, Ben?
It gave the impression of a helical structure.
And who was the one that recognized that? Who was the one that outlined the entire theory of helical structure?
Francis Crick.
Exactly. Did Franklin recognize that?
She did. Right before they pretty late discovered
in
the structure, yeah.
She had those pictures for an awful long time, didn't she? Didn't recognize it. But Crick did, once Watson got the right pattern, correct?
Right, yeah.
Exactly. What else was used? Didn't know I was going to ask you this stuff. What else was used? Were you skiing, Jordan?
I was just surfing today.
Oh, good. How was the water?
Good.
Where'd you do it? Good, good. So what else did they use, Jordan?
I assume that Hershey's
so we have
crucial experiment was...
Avery's, not Hershey. You got Hershey, but Hershey was actually this experiment.
Yeah.
You learned right, but it's the wrong experiment.
Avery's experiment, which pretty much gave... sufficient evidence that DNA was the genetic
material. Yeah, exactly.
Material.
If it wasn't for that experiment, they wouldn't even been thinking about DNA. So we got Avery's experiment, we have Chargaff's rule, chemistry of nucleotides, chemistry of bonds, we have X-ray diffraction pictures, helical theory, all of that stuff came together in a particular way. Sam, what do you think about using these X-ray diffraction pictures that were shown on the board by Franklin for making a model?
I think it was a good idea.
Think it was anything unethical about it?
How so?
No, I'm asking, do you think...
Well, give me a more specific leading question.
Do you think that there was anything wrong with Watson copying, even if it was wrong, or in the end, you know, getting it right, the pattern that Franklin showed, you know, in one of her lectures?
Well, I think in the pursuit of scientific knowledge, there's really no concern for ethics.
So it was presented in an open forum, though?
No.
I disagree with that. Do you think that Franklin gave an open lecture?
Probably.
It was a public lecture that Watson...
I mean, I would probably be a little bit frustrated if
but
I
was
Franklin.
Open lecture, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it was communicated to...
Yeah.
So when we talk about patents, you'll see that that's a public disclosure, meaning once it's in the public domain, it's free game for anybody to... In other words, it's public knowledge. So if you put it on the internet, if you put it in a lecture, if you tell somebody about it, if you talk to somebody about it, you've now disclosed it as just knowledge for knowledge's sake, and anybody can act on it. What do you think about Watson and Crick looking at one of those pictures that Wilkins showed them? Remember that Franklin didn't think it was a double helix. She never thought it was a double helix. And she was crunching away in this Patterson solution, which is a very complicated physical chemistry solution. And ultimately, she would have got there. But it was the long way to do it, the very precise scientific way to do it, but very long. And remember, she penned Wilkins, this is all in the record, this stuff exists, saying something about the demise of your wonderful double helix model, and sent Wilkins all of the pictures of this B form, which was the simple form, as opposed to the A form, which was the more complicated form. What do you think about Wilkins showing Watson and Crick those pictures of Wilkins?
Well, it may have been a violation of the trust when the pictures were shown to him.
Why do you say that?
Well, I think it would depend on, if she just kind of sent them to him and was just... You know, they were just sent blindly, but if it was like, don't show anyone this is what I'm working on.
Never was said.
So, then, it's tough luck, I think.
What do you think, Heather? Didn't know I was going to get into this, did you?
I think it's the same sort of thing. She didn't have a patent on it or anything like that, and she didn't specifically say, this is my work, don't copy it, she gave it to him, kind of to rub it in his face, and it kind of backfired on her.
Yeah, it kind of backfired on her, but the ironic thing about all of this is that after all of this stuff, Crick became Franklin's best friend, actually. And when she died of ovarian cancer at the age of 37, she actually died in the house of Crick and his wife. So in some respects, it was a very small community. It's actually a very interesting history, and a lot has been written about this whole thing. And if any of you are interested in the history of science, it's another example of a really fascinating, fascinating, fascinating situation, which many of the players still exist and have been interviewed that were there, like Raymond Gosling, the student, he still is alive, and Wilkins just died, but he gave, his point of view, and Crick just died and gave his point of view, and of course, we know what Watson's point of view is, but there were a lot of other players that were there that are still around to give their story of how all this happened. But the point here is, good job, that we have a double-stranded molecule, we have a double helix, and it has to be able to replicate. And one of the keys to the solving of the double helical structure by Watson and Crick was insights into the replication process, as you recall, in the film that I showed in class. It's kind of like Eureka. This is the way the molecule of life is transmitted from generation to generation, because if we have complementary base pair relationships, one strand dictates automatically the sequence of the other strand. So in a very, very, very famous experiment, which I'm not going to go into, called the Meselson-Install experiment, it was shown exactly how the DNA molecule replicates. And this was done about 5 years after the double helical structure was solved by Watson and Crick. The question was, what's the mechanism? How does this work? And what it was shown was that each strand of the DNA separates from each other, and each strand of the DNA serves as a template for a new, what is called, daughter strand. And so if this is the Crick strand, that serves as a template for a new Watson strand. If that is the Watson strand, it serves as a template for a new Crick strand. And complementarity is maintained because that's the blueprint for what the strands are. Polarity is maintained because that's the only way the molecule can be put together, by antipolar strands going in opposite direction. And the double helical structure is maintained. But the most important thing out of all this is that the sequence is maintained from generation to generation to generation. The only exception, a mistake, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, of a mutation which spontaneously occurs. And so the story here is that this molecule separates. That molecule has two strands. Each strand serves as a template for a new daughter strand. We get two new daughter molecules. Each of those double-stranded molecules goes into different cells. So we start with, let's say, one DNA molecule in one chromosome. That DNA molecule replicates. So if it's a chromosome, the DNA molecule originally looked like this. You have DNA replication, and what you'll see is something like that. So this is a double-stranded DNA. This is now two double-stranded DNAs. And when the cells divide, each of those chromosomes go into each of those DNA molecules into separate cells. Because the sequence is maintained identically, those cells maintain the same genotype. If the same genotype is maintained, the key then is to be able to maintain the same phenotype. And so what I'm saying here is that the DNA is replicated faithfully from generation to generation. After it's replicated faithfully from generation to generation, what also has to be replicated faithfully is the ability to produce the exact same phenotype. And that's a whole other, much more complicated problem. What I'm saying here is, if the skin cell divides into two skin cells, the two new skin cells still must be a skin cell. They can't change into a kidney cell. If two kidney cells divide into four kidney cells, those kidney cells still must be a kidney cell. So it's not sufficient just to replicate the genome and the sequence. You have to replicate the ability of the genome to produce proteins in the cells in which it's been replicated in exactly the same way. And if I put the complexity of DNA replication at a 1, the complexity of maintaining what genes are active in those cells after division and after replication is of the order of 10 to the 9th in complexity. And we still haven't approached understanding that process. Daisy, did you understand what I said? Lisa, did you understand what I said? I want to make sure, because it's very subtle here. Nick, did you understand what I said? Go ahead. Daisy?
So just kind of to clarify, when something's replicating and it makes like the same sequence, so we have the exact same genotype, you're just saying perhaps like maybe one of the proteins won't be functional, so the trait won't be expressed, and therefore the phenotype will be different.
What I'm saying is that if you have a skin cell, all 46 chromosomes have to be replicated faithfully when that skin cell divides to make two skin cells. So those two skin cells have all the genes in the human genome faithfully. But that doesn't say that those two cells are skin cells. The program that specifies which genes in the genome manifest the properties of being a skin cell also has to be perpetuated from cell division to cell division. In other words, all of the genetic regulatory mechanisms that say this is a kidney cell, this is a skin cell, this is a hair cell, this is a heart cell, not only do those cells have to be replicated faithfully with respect to the genes, but which genes are on and which genes are off and which genes are working and which proteins are going to be produced, that machinery has to be faithfully replicated from generation to generation. And that's the most complicated process of all. But it's obvious because, you know, you take showers every morning, I hope, or night, or at least once a day, and, you know, you slough off a lot of skin cells, and you make new skin cells by division. But those skin cells have to know that they're skin cells. And so that machinery that says maintain the phenotype, division after division, also has to be replicated, as well as just the DNA sequences themselves. And that's something that's very important to keep in mind. And the only way that you can change that, in essence, is by genetic engineering, inserting a new gene that will cause the cell to do something differently. And I'm going to come back to that point in a few minutes. So what we have is DNA replication. Every time the cell divides, the chromosomes divide faithfully, and they divide in what has been called semi-conservative replication. Semi-conservative replication. And what that means to a molecular biologist is that we have two DNA strands in a molecule. That molecule divides into two double-stranded DNA molecules. But those two new double-stranded DNA molecules each has one strand from the parent molecule. In other words, we start with two molecules, two DNA strands. They separate. Those parental strands go into both of the new DNA molecules. So the DNA strand is conserved. Jordan? Called semi-conservative replication.
Isn't some DNA replication not actually semi-conservative in certain viruses and bacteriums?
All double-stranded DNA is replicated semi-conservatively.
Okay.
Okay? You can have conservative replication, but generally you only have one strand to begin with. So in those cases, you have single-stranded DNA viruses. But everything on a cellular level that has a double-stranded DNA as a basis is replicated in a semi-conservative manner, where you have two strands of DNA, they separate, and in the two daughter DNA molecules, each of those daughter DNA molecules has one of the parental strands, and that's why it's called semi-conservative, as opposed to conservative, where both strands would be conserved, going to one daughter molecule, and two new strands that were newly synthesized would go to the other, and it's not like that. And this is a very elegant experiment that was carried out by people by the name of Meselson and Stahl at Caltech, 1957, beautiful experiment. Those of you going on in life sciences, you'll know everything there is to know about that experiment. But for here, all you have to know is that sequence is maintained faithfully. Now, in order to have this sequence maintained, things have to happen. One, it has to be regulated. I mean, cells just don't divide all the time. And when it's not regulated, Sommer, we get cancer. It's unregulated cell division. So these cell divisions and DNA replications are exquisitely regulated. And when something happens to that regulation, we get cancer. And that's really the fundamental basis of cancer in humans and other mammals. And it's a disaster. It's horrible. It's depressing. It's awful. And so you imagine it has to be maintained and regulated in very specific ways because many of your cells, like liver cells, heart cells, kidney cells, they don't divide anymore. And if they start dividing, Matt, then you get a tumor. And that's not so much fun. And so the point here is that cell division has to be highly regulated and involves a very precise sequence of events, maintaining the double-stranded structure of the DNA, and requires enzymes, very complicated enzymes, which are proteins, that catalyze the production of the phosphodiester bonds. So in order to replicate the DNA, you need a template, which is the DNA in the chromosomes. You need an enzyme called DNA polymerase, which catalyzes the new phosphodiester bonds that are formed in the new DNA strands. You need nucleotides, obviously, because those are the raw materials for the new DNA strands. And you have to have a regulatory machinery that says, now is the time for cell division. Now is the time for DNA replication. Get it over with and stop. And that's a very complicated process of which we still don't understand all of the different aspects of it. But in general, it's much more complicated than that, because the DNA is a double helix, and if you've ever put two strings together and you unwound them, you'll know that they start spinning. You've all seen that with your telephone cords or whatever. And so you can't have DNA spinning in a cell, so there's all kinds of other proteins and enzymes that prevent that from occurring which I'm not going to go into, but the point is that this is an extremely complicated process that involves probably 500 different proteins, which means there has to be about 500 different genes that are just participating in the replication of DNA in both bacteria and in eukaryotes. But the point here is that the DNA sequence lives forever. And that's what Watson and Crick said. This is immortal. All of your DNA sequences go back to time immemorial. The sequence, not the molecule, but the sequence has been there for, you know, a few billion years in part. And so that's because of the replication of DNA. Now I'm going to tell you something very specific that I want you to grab onto. It's conceptual, but it's going to be important because I need to tell you this when I talk about the polymerase chain reaction. In order to replicate the DNA molecule, it just doesn't happen by itself, as I said. You need a template, which is the chromosome, the double-stranded molecule to begin with. You need these nucleotides, which are the raw materials in the nucleus or in the cell if it's a bacterial cell. Deoxyribonucleotides, not ribos. You need this enzyme. You need these other proteins. But DNA replication can't start on its own. You need these little things called primers. And I'm not going to go into really what these primers are. But you all know from your discussion that there's this thing called the origin of replication. And I'm going to talk about this in a second, called the ORI. And remember that the ORI is very important for plasmids and for vectors so that they can replicate in E. coli cells. Well, what binds to the ORI are these things called primers. And these primers are very short, single-stranded nucleotides, you know, 15, 20, 30 bases in length. And those primers are very specific for the origin of replication. Because as you'll see in a couple minutes, the origin of replication has very specific nucleotide sequence. Hey, everything has very specific nucleotide sequences. That's how everything works. The point here is that when the DNA separates and DNA replication begins, it doesn't begin randomly. It begins at these origins of replication. And because these origins of replication have specific sequences, the DNA polymerase recognizes those sequences. In other words, everything occurs by sequence. So the enzyme that copies the DNA recognizes those sequences, but it doesn't recognize the sequence in a single-stranded form. It recognizes the sequence in a double-stranded form because this little primer right here will bind to the sequence at the origin of replication. What I'm saying is that there's an origin of replication where everything begins. When the cell says start to divide, Brian, wake up, when the cell says start to divide, and if you need some sleep, I don't mind, but go home. I'm very empathetic to that, okay? Not in my class. So when the cell starts to divide, it's at the origin of replication. At the origin of replication, the DNA polymerase knows to recognize those sequences, but it won't recognize those sequences unless these little primers are bound to those sequences. And what you can see here is that this is the template strand right over here of one strand of the DNA. That's the template strand. And what you can also see here is that there's a little primer associated with it. And that's what tells this enzyme, which is very complicated, to bind to this thing and to add a new nucleotide. And you're going to see why this is so important. You're going to see exactly why I'm telling you this in a second. I know it doesn't make a lot of sense to you now because it's a little bit technically difficult, but the point here is imagine you have a double strand of DNA. There's an origin of replication. I'll show it to you in a second. It opens up. At that point, these little primers are complementary to each strand of the DNA. This polymerase then will bind to this structure. Part of it is single-stranded, which is the template. Part of it is double-stranded. These are these little primers binding to the template. Notice what's free here, this OH, a 3' OH, always on the primer. Notice the primer will have a phosphate here and an OH here. So the primers are always 5' to 3'. They always pair with the 3' to 5' strand. The reason why that's important is the DNA polymerase will only bind to a 3' OH. The reason why that's important is that's how the polarity of the DNA is maintained. That's how the DNA polymerase knows to take this chain and grow it in a 5' to 3' direction. That's how this DNA binds, this is how this DNA grows, because this nucleotide, as I've showed you, which is the hub, has an OH at the 3 carbon and phosphates at the 5 carbon, and it's those phosphates at the 5 carbon that join with the OH at the 3 that make a phosphodiester bond. So that chemistry has to be very specific, and the only way that can work is if there's this free 3OH that starts the whole process out. Again, bear with me because you'll see exactly why that's important in a few minutes. There was a question. Yuditha, did I answer it? Okay. So the machinery relies on these little primers, and these primers are made in the cell by a different mechanism that I'm not going to get into, but they're crucial in both bacteria and in eukaryotes for initiating the DNA synthesis. Okay. Now, let me talk about these origins of replication. Here's the sequence of the E. coli genome. There it is. The whole sequence has been completed. There is the origin of replication. DNA replication occurs here. Notice there's an arrow that goes in this direction. Notice there's an arrow that goes in that direction. That's because DNA replication doesn't occur in one direction. DNA replication is actually going in two directions. What's your hypothesis for why that is, Charles? Why would DNA replication go in two directions off of a chromosome? What do you think would be causing that? Both strands are being replicated at the same time, by the way. Not going to get into that. But we have bidirectional DNA replication. What's your hypothesis for why that would occur? Just give me a reason.
Because there's two strands, so...
No, each of those double-stranded molecules is being copied at the same time in both directions. So I don't want you to think that one strand is being copied in this direction, one strand is in that direction. It's kind of like a paper clip, and the DNA polymerase is copying both strands at exactly the same time. And I know it doesn't make sense because they're going in the opposite direction, but if you looked at the mechanism of DNA replication, one strand goes like this, and the other one actually loops back. So it's actually going in the different direction geometrically, but from a molecular point of view, don't worry about it. Both strands are being copied. So why would they go in two directions? Just give me a hypothesis.
Because of the polarity, maybe?
Polarity has nothing to do with it because we have two strands of DNA. One polymerase molecule is moving in this direction, copying both strands at exactly the same time. One molecule of polymerase is going in that direction, copying both strands at the same time, and then they meet at this thing called the terminus. Why do you think that would happen? Your chromosomes have many, many, many origins of replication, all of which are copied in a bidirectional manner. Why do you think that would be? What would be your hypothesis? What do you think?
Can I call on someone? Or?
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay, well, I'm going to hand it down to the people who are raising their hands.
Got to call by specific names. You have pictures of everyone in the class.
I can't see her name tag. I'm sorry, what's your name? Karina? Mm-hmm. I'm calling Karina.
Go ahead.
Sure, if it's right, but I hypothesize that it's like that because then you only need one origin and it's faster than just going from one end to the other end.
What's the second thing that you said?
There's only one origin.
Second thing that you said?
It's faster.
Yeah, exactly. There's only so much time you have to do this. Imagine replicating, in the case of E. coli, 4.3 times 10 to the 6 nucleotides in less than 5 minutes. That's a lot of DNA to copy in a short amount of time. The only way that can happen in the case of E. coli is to have one origin and have it go bidirectionally, so it takes half the time that it would take to do it from one origin in one direction. And human chromosomes and mammalian chromosomes and plant chromosomes work the same way, only they're linear. And instead of having one origin, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of origins because in the case of humans, you've got to replicate 5.5 times 10 to the 9th nucleotides in less than 15 minutes. Sam the man.
Is that true in...
Everything.
So it's is it a evolutionary thing, or it's just a...
Well,
did it, could, in a well, sense, I mean, how could you conceive of something not going bidirectionally?
Everything's evolutionary. The point here is if you have to cell divide in a certain amount of time, you have to replicate all of your genes in less than that time. And since the enzyme is a machine, and it actually moves, and it only can move at a certain speed, and if it has all of these nucleotides to copy, and it only can go so fast, the only way you can replicate all the genes, at least in this simple bacteria, is to go in two directions. The only way you can replicate all the nucleotides in your cells is to have thousands of these origins all going in different directions, because now we're copying 1,000 times more DNA, and the polymerase moves at the same rate. Okay, so again, you have to think about the enzymes that copy these things or transcribe the DNA into RNA as little machines. And their motors are running, and the reason how their motors are running, because they're getting energy. And what's the energy that drives the motor? Well, notice that on the nucleotides to begin with, the raw material, so to speak, on these nucleotides, Sam, how many phosphates are on that nucleotide? Those are high-energy bonds. And those phosphates are made when you breathe. That's a process of respiration. These nucleotides are made as an outcome of respiration and metabolism. And without you using oxygen and respiring, eating things, you can't make these nucleotides. And it has three phosphates. There's a lot of energy in those phosphates called potential energy. And when those phosphates are broken, that energy is released and changes the kinetic energy and actually powers this enzyme to move along the DNA. So these are, in fact, machines. And the machines are being moved by fuel, in this case, not, you know, ethanol or gasoline, but it's actually the energy stored in the bond of the phosphates of the nucleotides. And, in fact, they do move in real time. They're just not sitting there. So, again, because they only move so fast, and they have a geometry to it, they have to move, you have to speed the process up, because if you don't replicate all the genes, the cell dies. If you're a single-celled organism and you miss about 10, 15, 20 genes, the organism isn't going to survive. So from an evolutionary point of view, there's a selective pressure to replicate the genome faithfully and as quickly as possible. Those are the two most important things. That's why it goes in a bidirectional direction. Now, before I get to you, Nick, when you do genetic engineering, if a gene is inserted into a chromosome or into a vector, the gene is being replicated because it's using the origin of replication of that chromosome of that organism. When you stick a human gene in the bacterial genome, let's say in a plasmid, and I'm going to get to that in a second, you're using the origin of the replication of the plasmid to replicate the human gene. If you stick a human gene in a mouse chromosome, you're using origins of replication next to the position where that gene was inserted in the mouse chromosome as the origin of replication to replicate the human gene. So these origins of replication is what allows genetic engineering to perpetuate a gene from generation to generation to generation. The baby that got the good adenine deaminase gene that was allowed to prevent this skid formation, that adenine deaminase gene that went into the bone marrow cells used origins of replication in the chromosomes where that gene was inserted. And that's important in terms of the replication. Nick. This is just conceptual. It's important for you to understand this only for one reason. Because this is the basis of how you genetically engineer an organism from a stable point of view from generation to generation. And this is the basis of using vectors for genetic engineering. Because you've all heard about plasmids. You've been using them on your quizzes. You've been discussing them in discussion. And the only reason why you can use a plasmid as a vector to perpetuate a piece of DNA is because of these origins of replication. Before I get to your question, Nick, here's an electron micrograph of an origin of replication. This is a double-stranded DNA, that's a double-stranded DNA, and here are the two daughter double-stranded DNAs that are being replicated. This is moving in that direction, and that is moving in that direction. That's being captured in an electron micrograph. And show you one more. If this was like a human chromosome, you'd be looking at something like this. You'd be looking at origins of replication in many places, each one moving bidirectionally out from each other. And eventually they meet. You can see you have one new strand, one old strand, semi-conservative replication. You don't have to get in that detail, but I just want you to know what these origins are doing. Nick, go ahead.
I was going to ask if, I'm thinking now from those last slides you just showed that it is, hopefully I'm not making a fool of myself, but that is that the Christmas tree then?
You never make a fool of yourself in class, Nick.
Okay. Was that the little, is that the Christmas tree thing?
No, the Christmas tree thing is RNA being transcribed.
This is
replication and not transcription. Okay?
No. And then one other question, when you're talking to Sam, what is makes it the time limit for 5 minutes for a bacteria and 15 for a human?
Well, there's two things that make the time limit. That's kind of a teleological question. I mean, I can't answer what causes a cell to divide in 3 minutes. It just does. I can't answer what would be responsible for a cell taking 24 hours to replicate. Some cells do. They just have certain times depending upon what cell they are, whether it's a eukaryotic cell. Those cells divide at a much slower rate and take a little bit longer. Bacterial cells have to divide very fast because they have to. They have these niches that they have to explore very rapidly. And so that exact time depends upon the cell, where it's growing, bacteria versus multicellular, et cetera. However, if the time is fast, which it usually is in a prokaryotic cell, then the genome has to be replicated pretty fast. But again, that enzyme can only move so fast. It's like you only can run a mile so fast. Those machines can only move so fast. And that's the rate-limiting step in speed, is how big the genome is and how fast that enzyme can move along the DNA. Editha? It's fascinating stuff.
With the origins of replication, replicating the DNA, because humans have multiple origins of replication, do they replicate only those nucleotides that code for a protein, or do they replicate all the nucleotides?
What do you think? You answer that question.
Okay.
You answer that question.
I think they code all of them. I hypothesize.
You hypothesize, or do you know?
I know.
Yes, go ahead.
That they code all the nucleotides.
Code or replicate?
Well, they replicate all the nucleotides.
Yeah, if you didn't, you'd be a disaster.
Oh, because that's the RNA. Never mind.
An absolutely unmitigated disaster.
Okay.
And what experiment did I show that proved that that was the case last week?
That all of it replicated?
Yeah. I went over at least two experiments in class that proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that all of the genome is replicated after every cell division, and gave you some very fascinating experiments that showed that was the case. What was that? Kyle. Physics, Kyle. What was that experiment?
I don't remember.
Think about frogs. Think about frogs. Chris? Something that all of you think about all the time. Anton? Come on, you haven't been looking at your notes. Betty? Easter? Really elegant experiment. I spent at least 40 minutes on it. Radina?
It was the experiment where they took the frog egg and enucleated it and put in
the
other.
They took the nucleus out and they cloned the frog. If the genome wasn't completely replicated, in each case, you could have never cloned a frog because you're getting a frog from a single nucleus. And the single nucleus was from a skin cell. And if that skin cell hadn't been derived from something that had the whole genome, you could never do that. And the conclusion of that experiment was all the genes that were required to perpetuate and develop an entire organism was conserved in a cell, even though the cell was highly specialized. And that's the basis of all cloning, whether it's a cat or a human or a dog, or whatever. I saw some hands. Let me move on. Okay, you with me? Yeah, Josh, I thought I saw a hand. You with me, Josh, or not?
Yes.
Good.
My question is just more of a clarification. So then that implies that the frog experiment, along with what we've been talking about, implies that the nucleus's purpose ultimately is just to contain the genome, while the rest of the cell contains what causes what is expressed.
Right.
Is that correct?
So the nucleus doesn't really have a purpose. It's just a compartment.
So if you took those numbers 1 and 10 to the 9th, then the 1 would be the nucleus's complexity in terms of function, and then 10 to the 9th would be the cellular?
Probably, if that's what you want to look at. It's not really the cellular, because you can't divorce the nucleus from the cytoplasm. Remember, transcription occurs in the nucleus, and a lot of other things occur there. So the cytoplasm is just where the proteins are made. All of the regulatory apparatus that says this is
within the nucleus?
Is within the nucleus. For the most
so then
part.
How? So if all the regulatory
for the most part,
if any regulatory mm-hmm. Functions existed within the nucleus, and you took the nucleus out of a skin cell and put it inside of an enucleated
egg, yes,
and yet you get a frog, doesn't that imply that the regulatory functions are in the rest of the cell of the egg rather than the nucleus?
How do you infer that?
Because otherwise you would end up with a skin cell. Or you'd end up with a messed up cell?
Not necessarily, because all the genes that are required to make the frog are in the nucleus.
Right, right.
So maybe they get reprogrammed when they get put into the egg, because maybe there's regulatory proteins or information in the cytoplasm of the egg that then go back to the nucleus and kickstart the whole process, like starting a computer program.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay? Right. So you can't think about things as being divorced. Everything is interacting with everything else. Everything is holistic. You can't take one without the other. So it's kind of like the chicken or the egg process. When does life begin and when does life end? There is no beginning and there is no end. Life does not end and life does not begin. It is a continuous wheel. It's because everything in the egg is there that sets off the first stages of, let's say, animal development or plant development. So those things that set off the development are in the egg, but they tell the genes in the nucleus after fertilization which genes are to be active early on in the development of that organism. And so there's an interplay between the two. And those genes that make the proteins that are in the cytoplasm of the egg are only active when the egg gets made. And those proteins are only present in the egg. And those proteins are dormant until fertilization occurs. Fertilization occurs, that's a trigger. Then those proteins tell the new diploid nucleus which genes should be manifested early in embryo development, whether it's a plant or an animal, to become that organism. And then when that organism has cells that give rise to eggs, again, those genes that have to set this whole program up are expressed, those proteins are made, they're stored in those eggs until fertilization comes. So it's a dynamic wheel. Never begins and it never ends. Okay. Nick, one question and I'm going to move on. Related to what I'm talking about.
So in the video yesterday when they had the three-way transplant with the cytoplasm, so my understanding is like the genetic regulatory information about the cytoplasm is not in the nucleus, because like if that woman, her eggs didn't actually produce correct functional cytoplasm that would replicate.
That only dealt with mitochondrial genes. That didn't deal with nuclear genes. That dealt with genes that are present in the little compartment of the cell that makes energy called the mitochondria. And we'll talk about that. That there's genes in your cytoplasm outside of your nucleus. Okay. Those genes are in compartments called mitochondria, which makes the energy for the cell. If your mitochondria don't function, you're dead.
Okay.
If you take cyanide, it poisons your mitochondria and you die, because it doesn't allow you to make energy. And so the point was that you can have defects in the genes in the mitochondria, and if you do, they can have very serious defects in a little baby that's born from a woman that has a mutation in the mitochondrial genome, because the mitochondria have their own genes. Okay? So how would you know, Nick? How would you know that a defect in a human being is due to a defect in a gene in a mitochondria? How would you know that? What would you predict? The inheritance pattern would be. What would you predict? How come they were concerned about that in that film yesterday?
How would they know the defect?
I'm asking you.
I'm clarifying the question.
How would you know that there was a defect in that mitochondrial gene? Gloria, could I have a better blue pen, please? That one's dead. So there's the cell, there's the nucleus, and there's this little thing called the mitochondria. I think you have to go back to the lab. So there's this mitochondria. And let's say there's a defect in that mitochondria. How would you know that that defect was in the mitochondria as opposed to the nucleus? How would they know to be able to use that procedure on that woman? I mean, he wouldn't do that with anyone. I mean, if it was a defect in the gene in the nucleus, you wouldn't do that cytoplasmic replacement procedure. They're getting rid of that cytoplasm to put in a good cytoplasm that has good mitochondria.
There's a problem with her
eggs. How would they know that? How would they know that? What would you predict? Now let's get back to predictions and hypotheses. So the hypothesis is that there's a defect in a gene in the mitochondria. How would you know that? What would the prediction be? I know it's getting ahead of the game, but it's important. You gave me an opening.
I guess I would.
You guess? What's the prediction? Predictions aren't guesses, they're just predictions.
I would predict that the cell would not be able to replicate because the...
How would you know that, though? You're not monitoring the replication of the cell. How would you know that there's a defect in a gene in a mitochondria? This woman's going to bring her eggs in. And not only is she going to undergo in vitro fertilization, she's going to undergo a cytoplasmic replacement. That's pretty serious stuff. Michelle Evans is going to talk about that in 2 weeks when she comes here and talks to us. But how would you know to do that? Would you give someone your eggs for in vitro fertilization if you want to have a child and say, take out my cytoplasm and put someone else's in?
She can't get...
I couldn't have children any other way.
But it wouldn't be a simple procedure. It's serious stuff. You'd want to know pretty hard that there was a defect in your mitochondria, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. So how would you know that? Matt?
There would be a... in the sequence that codes for
No, you don't know anything about sequences. Nothing. Not even a DNA sequencer exists. No sequencing, no molecular biology, no knowledge of DNA, nothing. How would you know?
Isn't it the phenotype?
Pardon?
If you're sterile or...
No, it has nothing to do with sterile or phenotype. Any phenotype can be due to a nuclear gene or anything else. Phenotypes are just mutations in genes, but it doesn't tell you where the gene is. How many of you handed in a quiz from last week? I can't see your hands. How many of you handed in a quiz from last week? Brian, go to the board and tell me what a pedigree is. How many of you signed your quiz from last week? Okay. Do you have those quizzes? Can you bring some in for me, please?
Pedigree is basically when you have...
What does a pedigree do?
It basically traces...
Doesn't basically.
It traces out...
What does a pedigree do?
It traces out the lineage from from a certain...
So what's the purpose of constructing a pedigree?
To trace a certain trait. For example, maybe a disease.
From what? Huh? Trace it from what? Trace it. I don't know what you mean by tracing.
Oh, is it like recessive? Is
no,
it
no, no. What's the purpose of a pedigree?
to see what traits like it has in the family.
From
the parents.
Generation to generation.
Okay.
So what's the purpose of a pedigree? The purpose is to trace from generation to generation, but that's not why you want to construct a pedigree. That's like a genealogy, you know, where did I come from? What's the whole purpose of establishing a pedigree?
To see how a certain trait is transmitted through the generation.
When you say see how, what does that mean?
Whether it could be transmitted from like father to son or father to daughter.
What does that mean from a mechanistic point of view?
Like where it's located on...
No. You're close. Go ahead. No, I'm not getting off. Okay. You know. Come on. From generation to generation, for what reason? Did Mendel follow genes from generation to generation?
Yes.
Did he have like little pedigrees?
No.
He didn't? How would he follow these things from generation to generation?
Yes,
What's the difference?
He did.
And what was Mendel able to establish from following those genes from generation to generation?
Patterns of inheritance.
Well, and what? What was he? Come on, Brian.
Patterns of inheritance.
The patterns of inheritance. So what's the whole purpose of a pedigree?
To trace the pattern.
I can't hear you. You got this you're all nervous and you're shaking and everything. And yeah, right. Stand up and just talk. Don't be nervous. You know it. Come on.
Sorry, what was the question again?
Yeah. It's the whole purpose of this pedigree. Okay, here we go. This is good. Find Brian's in here for me, will you? That's cool. What's the whole purpose of a pedigree to the class?
The whole purpose of a pedigree is to trace the lineage of, or not the lineage, to trace a trait through the generations from to basically check how it is transmitted from generation to generation.
Not how,
or
what the
pattern is.
What the mechanism is.
Yes.
So the whole purpose of a pedigree is to find out, one, whether the gene is inherited, the trait, whether it has a genetic basis, and secondly, to find out what its mode of inheritance is. Now, didn't you do this on this quiz?
Yes. It's just a little bit tougher to explain.
Why?
When you're down
if you know it, you know it.
Well, sometimes.
Didn't you sign, let me see, read what you said here. Can you read it for me, please? Out loud, just like you said before. One of the things that I'm trying to do is to get you all to be able to stand up in front of a class, in front of anybody, and give an answer without shaking like you have Parkinson's disease, because at some point you're going to be interviewing for business school or law school or medical school or a job, and you can't sit there like a mouse when you want to move on positively in your life. And so the most important thing is just learn it here, because you're not being graded or judged or anything else. Just trying to get you to just be confident and not talk like. Who's going to get the job, me or you, Brian?
You.
No, I want you to get the job, though. I don't need a job. I don't have to work for the rest of my life. I don't need any job. I don't need any money. I don't need anything. I want you to get the job. That's the purpose of this. I want you guys to get the job. I want you guys to articulate. I want you guys to be famous. I want you guys to be a million times more successful than me.
So you want me to read what I...
Yeah, signed? Read what you wrote.
So
Matt likes that, but it's true.
So you want me to read what I signed for?
Yeah.
Okay. I understand the conceptual basis of all my questions on this quiz, and I did not consult with anyone outside
Keep reading.
Of my HC78 class in order to answer quiz questions.
Keep reading.
I will be able to explain conceptually how I answered my quiz questions in either discussion section or lecture next week.
Read that over again, that last part, please.
I will be able to explain conceptually how I answered my quiz questions in either discussion section or lecture next week.
So next time, don't say, but it's harder to explain if you sign that statement. Because
okay.
If you sign that statement, I mean it. Now.
Okay.
It's not for me, seriously. Honestly, it really is for you. For all of you. Now. The mode of inheritance you put that, you don't mind me sitting here, do you?
I don't mind.
Okay. The mode of inheritance of that gene happened to be recessive, correct? You can look at your quiz.
Yes.
Do you want me to look at it and tell the class your answer, or you?
Well, yes. Yes, it is.
So what you learned from that was that the gene was a recessive gene.
Yes.
What else did you learn? Did you learn that it was on a sex chromosome or an autosome?
It was on an autosome.
So it wasn't on a sex chromosome. So now we learn the mechanism of inheritance. So going back to what I asked Nick, I know I'm completely diverging here, but you gave me an opening. How would you know whether or not the gene was on the mitochondria, was in the mitochondrial genome? What would you predict?
It would be like a maternal, for example.
Why would it be maternal?
Because the mitochondria is inside the egg, which is obviously produced by the mother in the ovaries.
What about in the sperm?
The sperm only contributes the
genome. No mitochondria in the sperm. So if you have a defect in the mitochondria, the only pattern that you can ever get is mothers transmitting the trait to 100% of their children. Fathers can't transmit it. And so it's called maternal inheritance. And it's very different than what you'd see. Now, if you had a gene defect on the X chromosome, on the Y chromosome, then you'd have paternal inheritance. Maybe fertility or something. That'd be a little bit more difficult because it couldn't be passed on because you wouldn't have any fertility on the male side, so it would just die out. Samantha.
Don't you have the same problem with this? Like, if it causes infertility?
I'm not the professor. Brian is.
Okay, but if it causes infertility...
Didn't say that it caused infertility.
It caused it with that woman.
Yeah, but that was one little thing.
Okay.
But there are other traits in the mitochondria that cause blindness, that cause mental retardation, all kinds of other things.
Okay.
Now, if it causes infertility, and again, we're going to have 2 hours of lecture on this by someone who knows infinitely more about it than I do, that doesn't mean that you don't have eggs. Because you have all of your eggs at birth. You don't produce any eggs in your entire life cycle. They're produced during embryo development. So one can be infertile as a female, but still, if it's due to this mitochondrial defect, you have an egg. If you have cytoplasmic replacement, then you can be fertile again because you have a good cytoplasm. I don't want to get into this. It's beyond the scope of what I want to talk about now. You're going to have all kinds of time to do that. I want to go on, Josh. What do you think, Brian? Can you read that last part again, please?
I will be able to explain conceptually how I answered my quiz and questions in either discussion section or lecture next week.
So the next time you're going to say, oh, well, but it's different and I can't do it and all of that, right?
I will not say that.
Yeah,
if I
know
I did
you won't do this. I know that. Thank you very much. You're brave, Brian. I like you. Okay, let me move on, and then we're going to take a break. Hold your questions because I want to get through some stuff and we'll come back. Origins of replication, very specific sequences. This is where DNA replication starts. This is where everything is. If you have an E. coli chromosome, there it is. It's an origin of replication. In this case, it's a 240 base pair sequence. That 240 base pair sequence is specific. Chris, can you clone it? Could I clone it and stick it in a plasmid vector? Absolutely. It's modular. I can take origins of replication. How would I have known what the sequence is to begin with? How would I have known that it was a specific 245 nucleotide sequence? How would I have known? Would I have had to clone it first? Would I have had to clone it, Chris?
No.
No? How would I have known what the sequence is without cloning it?
Yes, you would have.
Yeah, absolutely. And how would you know you had an origin of replication? If you cloned an origin of replication, what would you predict that it would be able to do?
It would be able to catalyze phosphodiester.
No, that's not what the origin is doing.
Okay.
That's the
enzyme.
That
was the polymerase?
The enzyme's doing that. How would you know you had an origin of replication if you cloned it?
Because replication would begin.
How would you know you had that origin of replication if you cloned it? What would you be able to do?
You would be able to make you would be able to have traits
expressed? No, forget traits, forget express. Haven't said anything about traits, haven't said anything about express, not even talking about it. We're talking about replication. If you had, how would you know you had this origin of replication? We cloned it. Let's say you're the first person that ever cloned an origin of replication. How would you even know you had it?
Sam?
The clone can replicate if replication can continue in the clone. That would mean there would be an origin
of
replication
there. In order to clone it, you had to use a vector. In order to use the vector to clone it, the vector had to have an origin of replication.
Yeah.
So how would you know you had the origin of replication when it's on a vector that has an origin of replication? What could you do once you cloned it? Ben?
It should replicate faster?
No. What could you do? Josh?
I'm not sure, could you use a primer to identify it as a kind of a probe?
It'd be awfully hard when you don't know what the mechanism is to begin with. Say you're the first person that ever found the origin of replication. Mizeo, what would you do to show that you had an origin of replication? What are the properties of the origin of replication? What is it able to do?
Well, it's able to start the
replication
process.
Cycle. So how would you know that you had it?
If the replication process started.
How would you know that the replication process started?
The fact that you have more of this.
What would you use to show that the replication process started? So you have a clone, you have a library, you have all these clones, and you hypothesize that one of them might contain something that is responsible for the beginning of DNA replication. Najla, what would you do? What would be the prediction? You're reading.
Yeah, I'm reading.
I don't want you to read. Give me a prediction. If it has a capacity to confer replication properties, what could you do?
I mean, somehow you would want to get it to replicate and only...
Not it doesn't replicate. It allows other things to replicate. So we have a clone with this origin of replication. But we used a vector that had an origin of replication in order to clone it, because if the vector doesn't have the origin of replication, you can't clone anything. Because that's what's responsible for replicating the DNA in the bacterial cell. So we're just randomly cloning these DNA sequences from whatever creature. But how would you know you had that if you didn't know what the sequence of an origin of replication is? Now we'd know by being able to sequence it and put it into a gene bank and, you know, do the things that you've done with bioinformatics and say, oh, it's a match. It's an origin of replication. But how would you know that to begin with? Lisa?
Get rid of the origin of replication of the vector?
Absolutely. Perfect. You try and take these sequences and put them in a vector that doesn't have an origin of replication. And if you found that one of these random pieces in your library was able to allow the vector to replicate, you'd know you had something which had an origin of replication. And that's how people clone the first origin of replication. Exactly with that. So they test fragment by fragment by fragment by fragment, putting them into a vector that didn't have an origin of replication. Ah, I have a fragment that has an origin of replication. What's the sequence? They sequenced it and found it was something unique. Thank you, Lisa. That's good. Okay, so we have these origins of replication. And these origins of replication are very important for genetic engineering and everything else. But the reason why I'm harping on them is they're important for genetic engineering because the vectors that are used, which are made by genetic engineering, all have an origin of replication. And that origin of replication sometimes on a vector is a plasmid origin of replication. But Sam, now that I've told you that origins of replication are modular, I could put on the same vector a human origin of replication, a plant origin of replication, a yeast origin of replication, a virus origin. I could put them all on one vector. And what would that vector then be able to do? A whole bunch of different organisms. Yeah. So if I took those origin of replications and I put it by genetic engineering on one vector, I could now use that vector to genetically engineer an E. coli cell, genetically engineer a yeast cell, genetically engineer a human cell, genetically engineer a plant cell, and that's exactly what's been done. So you don't just have a vector for bacteria or a vector for yeast or a vector for humans. It's all been engineered with these origins of replication to be able to replicate in any instance. And what I'm saying is that the origin of replication, which are a lot of fun to talk about, are specific for the origin, specific for the organism that they're in. So a bacteria origin of replication is good for a bacteria, simplistically. Human origin of replication is good for mammals. Plant origin of replication is good for plants. So in order to engineer these organisms and use vectors, if you want to perpetuate it in that organism on a vector, not in the chromosome, you need to have the origin of replication from those particular creatures. So the origin of replication is a specific sequence. What if the vector had a restriction site in the origin of replication? Would that be a good thing, Sam? Would you want a restriction site in an origin of replication? If you were using it as a vector to insert
things?
You don't want any restriction site in that origin of replication. You want it to be free so you can put this piece in something else. So the origin of replication does a lot of different things, but it's in all of these vectors, but it's derived ultimately from natural sequences in organisms that either plasmids or bacteria or whatever that allow these things to replicate. And it's the site at which the DNA polymerase replicates. It's the site at which, the primers bind. It's the site at which it all kicks off. It's neat. It's really neat. Now, what did I just say? I love talking about this stuff. I love teaching. It's fun. What I really am telling you in a conceptual sense is that nothing comes from nothing. In order to do these things with genetic engineering, again, it's circular. There's no beginning, there's no end. But something had to start at some point. In order to start at some point, as you know, with Stanley Cohn and Herb Boyer, they had to have a vector. And those vectors were the plasmids. And the reason why they could use the plasmids as the vector is they could replicate independently in E. coli chromosomes apart from the chromosome. And the reason they could do that was because those vectors, those plasmids, have their own origin of replication, which then allows the polymerase from the E. coli cell to bind and the primers and initiate the replication of the plasmid chromosome. The reason why we can insert the glowfish gene into a plant chromosome is that the glowfish gene, which does not contain an origin of replication, is able to use an origin of replication most close to it, where it gets inserted into the plant chromosome, as its origin of replication. And all of these origin of replications can be cloned. They can be then sequenced. Everything that you sequence has to be cloned to begin with. It's a very important rule. And they find them to have characteristic DNA sequences. So now when you sequence a whole genome, because origins of replication were cloned and sequenced 10, 15, 20 years ago, now when you sequence a whole genome, you can put that sequence into these databases, and you can say, this sequence is an origin of replication because it has certain features. The sequence has certain features. But the important point is that you need them to replicate a gene in a foreign nucleus, but you need them to make vectors, and all vectors are artificial. Now, before we take a break, which we're going to do in about 15 seconds, the reason why I'm going through all of this is because one of the most important breakthroughs in molecular biology, another important breakthrough, but particularly for genetic engineering, is this thing called the polymerase chain reaction. And when I had Javier here, remember Che Guevara? And I said, you did your whole PhD and did you ever clone anything? And he said, no. That's because he was using the polymerase chain reaction the whole time. And so in many respects, a lot of what you're learning now has been superseded by this thing called PCR or the polymerase chain reaction. Even Gavino can do the polymerase chain reaction. Second time around. Right, Mike? I'm just teasing you. But the point here is that this was a major breakthrough. And why was it a major breakthrough? Because before the era of the polymerase chain reaction, You had to do cloning the old-fashioned way, which meant that you had to use restriction enzymes, you had to make libraries, you had to have probes, you had to do all the things that you've learned about in your discussion. It was a very long process. And sometimes it took 1, 2, and 3 years to clone one gene. Now we can sequence the whole E. coli genome in less than a day and sequence it. But the point here is that the polymerase chain reaction allows you to essentially clone a piece of DNA from a genome without using all the recombinant DNA technology that you're learning here. However, in order to do this and use the polymerase chain reaction, this is the most important thing that you're going to learn from the polymerase chain reaction, you have to clone the sequence first. You cannot use the polymerase chain reaction until someone uses classical recombinant DNA procedures that you're learning in this class to find the sequence. So what underpins the polymerase chain reaction is recombinant DNA and genetic engineering. Without what you're learning in this class, you cannot use the polymerase chain reaction. And why? Because the polymerase chain reaction requires a knowledge of DNA sequences. And the only way you can get those DNA sequences is having a specific clone, Kyle, of the DNA that you want to sequence. You have to have been able to clone it in a vector, in a plasmid, and get it apart from all the other DNA sequences in the genome, and then sequence it using the things that you've been learning about in this class. Once you do that, you have a sequence, and now you can use the polymerase chain reaction to get that sequence anytime you want, never using a plasmid, never using a bacteria, never working with a live cell ever. This is a test tube procedure, and it's powerful. And it's democratized all of molecular biology. And what I mean by that is that anyone in this class can and will probably use the chain reaction at some point, maybe. But you could do it. We could do it in this classroom easily. Easily, we could do it in the time course of this lecture. And what we could do in the time course of this lecture, David, again, is something that would have taken us 2 years to do before the polymerase chain reaction was invented. So that means that anybody can do this. High school kids, junior high school kids can do it in your house, and the possibilities are unlimited because what it allows you to do is take one molecule of DNA, one molecule, and amplify it as much as you want. Amplify it absolutely as much as you want. What I mean by that is that from one molecule, you can get grams of that sequence. I'll say that again, grams. You can have enough to put in a salt shaker from one molecule. There's no limitation. And that's changed the whole ballgame. If it wasn't for the polymerase chain reaction, we couldn't sequence any genome. If it wasn't for the polymerase chain reaction, we couldn't do the kind of DNA testing we do both in medicine and in law and everything else, forensics, whatever. If it wasn't for the polymerase chain reaction, Mike wouldn't be doing the things that he's doing in the laboratory. We wouldn't be able to do anything without the polymerase chain reaction. So it revolutionized what we can do using genetic engineering and molecular biology. And the reason why I'm talking about DNA replication is the polymerase chain reaction is simply replication of DNA in a test tube. But it obeys exactly the same principles as what happens inside of a cell. You need a template, a double-stranded DNA molecule. You need a primer. You need a sequence, which is the sequence you're replicating. And you need this thing called DNA polymerase. You need nucleotides. You need everything, but you don't need an origin of replication because you basically make your own, which I'll show you about after the break. Let's take 5 minutes. That was one of Jessica's. She downloaded about 30 of these things on my computer the other day. I didn't even know what half of them were. Okay, is there any questions about what I've said? No, darn it. Yeah, is there any questions about what I've said so far? Radina?
Is it okay if it's not a question about what you've said? Something related?
Go ahead.
Okay. So one of the articles talked about how introns can become exons.
Why don't you save that a little bit, because that's, we're going to, I hope I'll get to that today, but if not, I'll get to that on Tuesday. Yeah, it's called alternative splicing. That's correct. Mm-hmm. So just hold that. It's a little bit ahead of where I am. Any questions? Happy? Good, so am I. Okay, so we have this thing called the polymerase chain reaction. And what's so neat about it is that if you have cloned a DNA fragment using, as I said, these classical procedures, and if you have sequenced it, using the polymerase chain reaction, you can amplify directly from a genome as a whole. And that's basically what we did in this class with your DNA fingerprint. So you gave us some cheek cells, Mike and Gloria and Tomo, a bunch of other people, extracted the DNA very simply. In fact, they didn't even extract, they just lysed the cells. The DNA, all of your DNA, was in a test tube. And then we used the polymerase chain reaction for a particular locus, D5 alpha, DQ alpha, which is a VNTR, and we amplified a particular part of your genome from a sample of the entire genome. And that's revolutionary, because obviously we weren't able to do that before the polymerase chain reaction was invented. And it was invented by a now Nobel laureate by the name of Cary Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for conceiving the polymerase chain reaction. He also filed, the company that he was working for, filed a patent on the polymerase chain reaction, which is now passed to many other companies. And anybody who uses the polymerase chain reaction, they don't know it, pays a little licensing fee in order to use the polymerase chain reaction, because it is a patented process. And so how does this procedure work? It works. It's too late, Jessica. Works because, just put it on my desk. Thank you. It works because you have a specific DNA sequence. You have some DNA in a test tube. You can synthesize primers to that DNA sequence. Those primers are specific for the sequence you're trying to amplify, because every gene sequence, every DNA sequence is unique. So if you know what that DNA sequence is, you can construct these little primers that are complementary only to the DNA sequence in the genome you want to amplify, meaning they're only complementary to specific DNA sequences. And they're complementary to those specific DNA sequences, and because they're complementary to those specific DNA sequences, you can use those primers to recognize those DNA sequences and only those DNA sequences within the genome as a whole, and use those primers to then set up a situation, which I'll show you in a second, called a template primer situation, which I just talked about a few minutes ago. And by setting up a template primer situation, you can then amplify that particular region. So what am I saying conceptually here? What I'm saying conceptually is that, let's say we have a DNA sequence. It could be a gene or anything. What we amplified from your genome was not a gene. It was just a particular piece of DNA. We know what the sequence is because that piece of DNA, and I'm going to say this over and over again, this piece of DNA that's blue on that screen was at one point in a library of specific clones that was cloned using recombinant DNA. And so at one point, this piece of DNA was cloned. And at one point, that particular piece of DNA was in a bacteria, in a plasmid vector. And at one point, that unique piece of DNA was sequenced. And once that sequence was obtained, Now you can use the polymerase chain reaction to amplify it from its locus in any genome without any cloning or anything, just using a replication process in vitro, because the primers will bind here and here to that target sequence. What the primers do is find the sequence that you want to amplify in a whole range of DNA sequences. So if you have a sequence of 100 nucleotides that you want to amplify, you can amplify that sequence in the whole genome, which is 5 × 10^9 base pairs. So it's able to pick out a particular sequence and then amplify it as much as you want because of the primers. And the primers will have a complementary base pair relationship to this strand and a complementary base pair relationship to that strand, which means before you use a polymerase chain reaction, you have to separate the template strands just briefly, allow the primers to form complementary double-stranded, little double-stranded DNA molecules with each strand, the beginning of this gene, the end of that gene, I'll show you a specific diagram, and amplify. The prediction then is that if you have the DNA sequence, Melissa, you know exactly the size of the DNA you want to amplify. So if your DNA sequence is 200 nucleotides, you know that you want to amplify a 200 nucleotide DNA sequence. If you amplify a 200 nucleotide DNA sequence a billion times, you're going to get one size DNA fragment. It won't be heterogeneous. It's going to be one size because the copying reaction is going to go from here to here, back and forth, and you're going to get fragments of exactly the same size, and that's going to be a diagnostic size for the DNA that you're going to amplify. And that's why you can use this for DNA fingerprinting, because when Harry Klann was here, he talked about we got this allele and this allele and this allele. What he was amplifying in those genomes was alleles that gave a very specific size because he knew the sequence of those alleles and because he had primers which were able to flank that sequence and give a very specific size. And so what you can see here is on a gel, and here's a gel electropherogram, here's a target piece of DNA which has been amplified over and over and over and over and over again. So you might start with this and you might get that. You can amplify it up to gram amounts. Let me say that again. If you know what the DNA sequence size is, you can amplify a very specific size DNA molecule. And that specific size DNA molecule will be of a specific length, 100 nucleotides, 200 nucleotides, 300, 1,000, whatever it is. It will only be the size predicted from the DNA sequence and the primer that you use to amplify that sequence between the primers. And that's why it's so powerful. If you want to amplify something that's a marker for sickle cell anemia, you get a specific size band for the sickle cell allele. The wild type allele gives a different size band. If you're trying to amplify a specific allele marker, you'll get a specific size. And that's because of the way it works. It's that specific, and it's that specific because it's done following all the rules of DNA replication. And it has tremendous number of uses, some of which are up here. We've talked about them. So it's to amplify a DNA sequence in tiny amounts. So you use it in basic science all the time. We don't clone anything anymore. We use a DNA polymerase chain reaction. We don't do any kind of cloning anymore. So it's very important for basic studies of gene activity. You can do it for studying any place where you have tiny amounts of DNA, a corpse, a hair, cells from my fingerprint, anything where you have tiny amounts of DNA, cells from one cell of an 8-celled embryo, a sperm, anything where you have limited amounts of DNA, you can use a polymerase chain reaction. That's why it's so revolutionary, and it's so specific. And so it's used in fingerprinting, forensics, law, evolution, disease diagnosis. If you want to know if you have a certain pathogen that's infecting you, use a polymerase chain reaction, because most of these pathogens' genomes have been sequenced. We don't use these crude antibody tests or any of that other stuff. If you think you have chlamydia, you're going to use a polymerase chain reaction. If you think you have herpes, it's going to be the polymerase chain reaction. If you're going to diagnose maybe certain specific cancers, you can use the polymerase chain reaction to see if that gene has gone haywire or has been mutated in any way. Polymerase chain reaction. Brian, wake up. You can use the polymerase chain reaction. Okay? So the point here is that this has revolutionized everything. This is why we know what cancer genes are cancer genes. This is why we know the sequence of the human genome. This is why we can fingerprint anybody in this room. This is why the whole human genome, plant genome, has been sequenced. This is why anybody in an elementary school can use this procedure. This is why you can synthesize whole genomes and construct whole genomes. Polymerase chain reaction. It's incredible. And it's easy. Anybody can do it. It requires very limited skills and very limited equipment and almost no money, and you don't even need a laboratory to do it. That's what's so incredible about this procedure in terms of what it can do. So how does it work? It works in the following way. There's a double-stranded DNA, which is the target sequence. That's a sequence within a whole genome. It's a part of a chromosome, part of a genome. That sequence is known because it's been cloned and sequenced, and let's say you want to amplify it. In order to amplify it, you have to separate the strands of the DNA a little bit to get templates. Those templates then are complementary to a primer at this end. Notice that's anti-parallel to that template. This primer is complementary to the other end. It's anti-parallel in that direction. Same rules of the DNA double helix apply. Anti-parallel nature. This is a double-stranded molecule. That's a double-stranded molecule. That's single-stranded. Little tiny DNA helix. The primer is the key. The primer is what gives specificity. The primer is synthesized from the DNA sequence. We take the DNA sequence, we put it in a computer, it's sent to a company, and the company synthesizes the primer you want in exactly the same order you want, 5 prime to 3 prime. So this primer goes 5 prime to 3 prime, that primer goes 5 prime to 3 prime. Obviously, they bind to the opposite polar strands. You then put these things in some kind of reaction, which I'll show you. You use a little machine. That machine takes temperatures up and down, because what's happening is you throw in some enzyme, and that enzyme binds to this primer and this template and extends the strand. Binds to this primer and this template, extends the strand. And notice the rules of replication are the same. Semi-conservative replication. Parent molecule, one strand becomes part of the new daughter molecule plus a new synthesized strand. The other strand becomes part of the second daughter molecule, newly synthesized strand. All the rules apply, but you wind up from one replication, two molecules. You then separate those, add new primers, which are in there, goes again, goes again, goes again, goes again. You do this 50, 60, 70 times in the same reaction. And that's why Harry called it a Xerox machine. And when you do that, you go 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the number of cycles is directly proportional to the number of copies that you get. It's 2 to the nth. 2 to the nth. N equals the number of cycles. You get infinite number of DNA molecules. And because you get an infinite number of DNA molecules, you can see them where you could never see them before diagnostically on a gel. Now you can see them, and it has a very characteristic specific size. And what are the requirements? The requirements are a knowledge of the DNA sequence. You must know this. You have to have a DNA polymerase, and that DNA polymerase can't be any old DNA polymerase. That DNA polymerase has to be able to survive high temperatures, because to separate the strands of DNA requires almost 98 degrees centigrade. And so therefore, that polymerase has to be able to survive almost boiling. And where did that polymerase come from? It came from hot springs. It was a bacteria which was found growing in Yellowstone in the hot springs. Obviously, if bacteria grows in hot springs, it can survive very high temperatures. People found the polymerases from this really remarkable bacteria and showed that the enzymes were stable at hot temperatures, which is what you'd expect. because this bacteria could grow at almost 100 degrees in Yellowstone National Park in these hot geysers. These bacteria that grow everywhere, even in Antarctica in cold conditions. So you couldn't use the E. coli polymerase because it grows in our gut at 37 degrees. So we have a heat-stable polymerase. We have a little programmer which takes temperatures up and down, and there it is, the one we use in our lab. One of them. We have many. Most labs will have 5, 6, 7 of these what we call PCR machines. And what you do is you put this in and you just program, take the temperature up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. Up temperature separates the strands of the DNA. The down temperature allows the primers to anneal with their complementary sequences and allows the reaction to go. Up temperature separates the strands again. Down temperature, primers bind again to the new DNA molecules and the old DNA molecules, and everything starts all over again. You need primers, as I've talked about, because primers are required to start any DNA synthesis reaction, whether it's in your cell or wherever. And you need to know the DNA sequence. It's all there. It's pretty nifty and pretty powerful and very important. And what are the applications? Well, there's many of them. So you saw one of them yesterday, prenatal genetic diagnosis, PGD. You saw the pictures, you saw the film, in vitro fertilization, 8-celled embryo. You can take one of those 8 cells and you can genotype it. If you have the human genome sequence, you can genotype every single solitary gene in your chromosomes. I'm saying that again. If you use in vitro fertilization and a knowledge of the human genome and a knowledge of all the 30 to 35,000 genes in the human genome, you can actually make a genotype of every single solitary one of your genes from a single cell. What do you think about that, Ms. Zale?
It's amazing.
Why do you think it's amazing?
Because you have the power to create so many genes that you actually can work with them better than just having one copy.
What do you think about being able to make a genotype from a single cell of an embryo that has the potential to be a human being before it even is implanted in the womb of a mother?
That creates a lot of responsibility for the people who are making those choices to create those things.
Well, we haven't created anything yet. We haven't selected anything. All I said is we can look at the genotype. We haven't done anything with the genotype.
Okay. Yeah, well,
that's like a big difference to do something with it than just to look at it.
Yeah, like the information also, because you can differ a lot from the information that you
and
have.
And most of the information, you won't know what to do with it anyways.
Yeah.
But the point here is that the polymerase chain reaction allows you to genotype a single cell from an 8-celled embryo. And how can you take that one cell from the 8-celled embryo, Ms. Zale, and still get a healthy kid when the 7 cells are implanted in the mother?
Because the rest of them will compensate for the one that's missing.
Exactly, because at the 8-cell stage, those cells have not differentiated from each other. They all retain the same ability to become any human cell that's possible. Okay, so the point here is that you can take these things and you can, with the polymerase chain reaction, hold on, Daisy, be able to amplify and look at genotypes. You can do this, you can sperm this, you can do this with sperm, you can do ancient DNA, you can do anything you want. So let me just show you. Let's say we have in vitro fertilization, and this is not done by many people that do in vitro. Some of them won't do sex selection, but they'll do sex selection. You can ask Dr. Evans about this. Sometimes they'll allow sex selection. If you have 5 kids and they're all females and you want a boy, then people will allow you to sex select. But if you have, let's say, no children and you just want to have a child because you have fertility problems and use in vitro, most places won't do sex selection because for obvious reasons. But we'll talk, you can ask a lot of questions about that in 2 weeks. But in this case, hypothetically, we have this SRY gene. That's the male gene. Remember we talked about that? Remember how we changed the XX mouse into a male? In other words, a potentially female mouse into a male mouse by using the SRY gene. I showed you that several weeks ago. So that means the SRY gene has been cloned. We know the sequence. If you know the sequence, you construct primers. If you know what the primers are, you can then do the polymerase chain reaction. So here we have eggs. These eggs are then fertilized using in vitro fertilization. Those eggs are then become 8-celled embryos. You then sample one of those cells by taking in this little tube. You isolate the DNA using the polymerase chain reaction with the SRY gene. You know, male, 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 res female. If you want a male, you just take one of these embryos, implant it in the womb. If it takes, it's about a 25%, 30% success rate. It's not 100%. You'll get a male or a female depending upon what you choose. But as you saw in the film yesterday, more importantly, if you have one of these very, very, very horrible disease genes and you want to avoid a child that has that, because I think it was pretty graphic in that film that that's not something that parents are happy about. It's pretty, pretty, pretty depressing. Then you can choose one of these embryos that would not have that particular situation occur genetically and use it. You can genotype a single sperm, as you can see, for a variety of different things using the polymerase chain reaction. Or the Jurassic Park scenario, you can then look at ancient DNA from creatures. You can't, you know, obviously get the whole genome because the DNA is pretty banged up. The Jurassic Park scenario is pretty hypothetical because the DNA is all chopped up and you're not going to get it all. You could never do this to sequence everything. Besides, you don't have the sequence of all the DNAs anyways. You can only use things that are highly conserved or you think are conserved, but you can get ancient DNA from, here's the years, 40 million years, 17 million, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you can compare from an evolutionary point of view those particular DNA sequences and try and understand how they evolved and how these creatures are related to the creatures that are running around today. You can use mummy DNA, and you can look, in fact, to see whether or not there are pathogens, what kind of pathogens affected these people that lived a few thousand years ago, what are their genes like. If you think that they might have something that might be a mutation, you can look and see whether they had a mutation. People have done this on Abraham Lincoln's DNA and have diagnosed them as having a certain genetic defect. You can do this in any situation you want. You can only do this with polymerase chain reaction and specific pieces of DNA. And, of course, you can use it in the crime scene, as Harry talked about and as you'll talk about. This is not done with DNA blots. This is done with the polymerase chain reaction. In this case, we have a particular suspect, and we have some crime scenes, and you can see that those bands kind of match. And so we have the suspect, which is OS. We have the crime scene, which is CS. And you can see that that's a perfect match for that one locus. As Harry talked about, you can do that with 13 loci. This happens to be O.J. Simpson and the crime scene. And I don't think that there's any doubt that he was responsible for the murder of Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. There's just no question at all. There's a 100% match over 15 to 20 different loci. Probability to be one in trillions that he wasn't the individual involved. The point is, here's one of the samples that was taken from that trial. This is all a matter of public record. This is not anything which is a mystery, but the point here is that you can use this to do a variety of different things. So is there any questions so far on the polymerase chain reaction? Radina? David, you have a question? Go. Go ahead. Ask them outside the class, not in the class. Go ahead, Radina.
Okay, I've seen this come up a few times, but why is it that...
Don't ask why. What is the reason?
What is the reason that you have to test or take an egg from a cell from an embryo when it's...
Tell me where
eight
you're
cells.
Going. Is this related to the polymerase chain reaction
to the
else?
Process, kind
ask
of.
Ask me something about the polymerase chain reaction.
Okay, never mind.
No, it's okay. We'll get to that quick. But ask me something about the polymerase chain reaction. Does anyone have a question about the polymerase chain reaction, DNA replication, how it's done, what it's used for? Sam?
Is it relatively cheap, cheaper than, you said it doesn't take as much time. What's the economics?
What would be the difference between having 10 people in a lab work for 2 years or having one sophomore undergraduate student work for 1 hour?
Yeah.
huge.
But still, in terms of like...
Huge.
Is it still expensive to... Dirt cheap, really.
Nothing. I mean, the prices have just come down. It's nothing. It's pocket change. Pocket change. I mean, Harry said it's about $1,000, but someone's overcharging the LAPD to do that, I'll tell you that. I think that the biggest price is the labor, because people have to do it. Any other questions? Radina, I'm running low on sugar. Go ahead.
When you're doing pre-implantation genetic testing, why do you have to, or why what is the reason that you have to take the cell when it's at the 8-cell stage? Is that an arbitrary number?
The 8-cell stage is a stage at which if you harvest one cell, you can maximize the development of the 7 cells. In other words, the rest of the cells will develop pretty normally if you let them go along. And also it's at the stage at which the cells are still totipotent, which means all the cells have the capacity for forming any cell type in the human body or in a mammal's body. It could be a mouse, it could be anything else. Beyond that, they start differentiating. And that's where stem cells come in, and we'll get into that a little bit later. So beyond that, at the blastocyst stage, that's called the morula stage, but at the blastocyst stage, the embryo cells have started to differentiate so that some cells of the embryo become the chorion and the amniotic sac that the little fetus grows in, and other cells become the fetus. And you don't want to harvest them because then you'll be disrupting the development of the embryo. But you don't disrupt the development of the embryo at the 8-cell stage, nor do you disrupt the development of any of the other cells because they all have equal potential. Any other questions? That's why it's used then. Okay. And that was a lot of experiments that had to show that, mainly in other mammals. Jessica, could you call someone and get the air conditioning turned on in here, please? Would you do that for me? Thank you. Go ahead, Nick.
This is just a very basic one. Why couldn't before
not
PCR?
Why.
What was the reason before PCR that they couldn't have done all these things without multiplying them? I mean, you could have before, but it would have been a lot more expensive and time-consuming. But, I mean, why do you need so much
not
of the
DNA?
For what reason do you need so much DNA?
What do you think the reason for that, Nick, is? Do you think you need to have a diagnostic procedure in which you could visualize one molecule of DNA? We're talking about now 10 to the minus 18th grams of DNA.
I mean, I guess...
No, I want you to answer that specifically. Do you think... In order to work with things, you have to visualize them. So do you think you could visualize one molecule of DNA and work with it? If you only had one molecule,
right?
You think you could do that? What's the purpose of cloning?
You have more, a larger amount.
Most amplifying, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, amplifying volume.
Exactly. So in answering your own question, could you do this before the polymerase chain reaction? The answer is on... your quiz. How did you do it with your quiz? You did it with your quiz. Where are the quizzes? Let's find Nick's quiz.
Well,
you did it on your quiz before the polymerase chain reaction. How did you do it?
Well, you can do the same process using the restriction enzyme and the vectors and that stuff.
But what are you using to work on the restriction enzymes and the vectors?
Using to
work. You have to have a source of something.
What's
the source?
I don't know. I'm getting a little lost.
No, you're not. You're doing great.
All right.
Not getting lost at all.
I'm getting help from you, Dita. Is that allowed?
No, you're not. I don't want you getting help because here's your quiz.
Okay.
Which is perfectly correct.
Oh, thank you.
So now tell me, what's the source of the DNA? Where'd you get that DNA to do all that stuff? Cleave the DNA with restriction enzymes. Where did you get it?
I just have a very bad memory.
Well, so. I don't know. That's your handwriting, not mine.
All right.
Cleave the DNA with restriction enzymes. Where'd you get that DNA?
I'm trying to remember what the question asked, so which DNA we were working with in that question.
Remember, I said the situation was that you had an individual that's afflicted with a disease, and there was a mutation in this allele, and that allele, et cetera, et cetera. So where did the DNA come from?
So we got it from the individual, probably
cheek
swab or
something. Did you get a lot or a little?
We only got a small amount.
You sure? Did you
No.
get a lot or a little?
Oh, we probably got a lot of DNA.
Yeah, because how would you be able to see it on a gel if you didn't get a lot of DNA? Because you had to visualize it by using gel electrophoresis.
Right.
And then you had to be able to transfer it with this blot, which very few people do anymore. And then, Gloria, just hold off on all those handouts until after class. I know, but they can come, you know, tomorrow and get them or something like that, okay? Thanks. So how would you get the DNA? You'd extract it, and then you have to visualize it. You have to work with it. You have to have it in a test tube, kind of like what you guys did, you know, when you spool the DNA. Remember, we saw it and stuff?
First day class.
You have to have a large amount. You either have a large amount by extracting it, or you have a large amount by amplifying it into bacteria. But what if you didn't have a large amount? What could you do?
Either PCR.
You would never be able to see it. You'd never be able to know you had it.
Uh-huh.
You'd never be able to work with it. You'd never be able to do anything.
Well, can I just clarify one thing?
Sure.
I mean, even when either by through using PCR or the older, more
forget
slow
the PCR,
method,
but go ahead.
Once we have more of the DNA, it's easier to work with if we have grams of it because we can see
well,
it
our
and visualize.
Well, micrograms, yes.
With our eyes, or at least
right.
easier with a microscope. But even then, the DNA itself, excuse me, is so small that you still are going to be able to.
Does class go to 6 or to 5:30? Am I missing something?
5:50.
Huh? Go ahead.
So, I don't know. I guess I understand why it's easier in the lab to, you can visualize the micrograms versus one tiny molecule, but then you still need to be able to zoom in at a molecular level to understand that.
So you zoom in on the molecular level.
It's just easier to
zoom
in. By
visualizing this on a gel or using autoradiography or some method of visualization or electron microscopy. And in order to do that, you have to have a certain quantity. And one molecule is not a sufficient amount of quantity in order to visualize, except with the most sophisticated and expensive procedures you could ever imagine. And so before the polymerase chain reaction, you had to isolate the DNA, let's say from your cells, and you had a large quantity. You could never do it from a cheek cell, because a cheek cell doesn't have enough of any one gene that you could visualize by the most sophisticated, let's say, DNA blot procedure. Because the DNA blot procedure, you require a probe which would then hybridize to that specific sequence, and that probe has a certain sensitivity of giving off radioactive stuff on a film, and unless you have enough of it, you'll never be able to see it because it's not sensitive enough. So there's limits with which your detectability so that you can see it and visualize it. Okay. So what the polymerase chain reaction allows you to do is to start with one molecule and amplify it up enough so then you can see it. Does that clarify? Because you got to work with things, and you have to have ways of visualizing. That's what's so nifty about it and so fabulous. Any other questions? You happy, Patricia? Victoria, are you happy so far? Karina, you happy? It's pretty amazing stuff, isn't it? I know. Pretty amazing, huh, Matt? I know. What's even more amazing about this is someone who thought about it from nothing and invented it. That's even more amazing. Okay. Let's do this in an orderly way, Mike. And the only orderly way to do this is to do it not up there. I don't know why those things are up there. But let me just listen to me before you leave. There's a number of things that you got to get, many things. And I think the most orderly way to do this is to have a number of piles in the front of the class so one can just go down this row and collect things rather than in one pile up there. So why don't you put all these different handouts up here, and you guys just hold on, and Gloria and Michael, get them up here, and take them and just file around and take them one thing at a time and just grab them. If anyone wants to help them, we'd appreciate it. No, I don't want it in that order because it's not going to make a lot of sense. Let's put them in the order in which they're, you know. Okay. Where's the other chapter? What's going on here? See, this is so complicated.